If you'll recall, I was here last month, and it was an interesting call came in on the phone lines from one of our listeners who told me about something called halfpasthuman.com and their use of what he called web bots to sort of predict the future. And me being a technophobe that I am, I didn't exactly know what he was talking about, but did a little research on it. And then our producer, Lisa Lyon, did some digging into it and talked to the guys we're going to be talking with now. And along the line, I also saw a news story that ran on the National Wires, and it said this. It said that there are two think tanks, the Arlington Institute and the web bots of halfpasthuman.com, who are independently forecasting what they called impending event alerts. In the case of the Arlington Institute, it was supposed to be something that happened in the next 60 days. In the case of the web bots, they had this impending event alert that was from October through February, but with a warning period during the period of September 22nd to the 27th, which is coming up this week. And each of these think tanks, according to the article, follow sort of a different pattern to figure these things out, but both are saying something comparable to a 9/11 event is coming down the pike, and that's pretty scary. Our guests, and I'm really looking forward to this discussion because they have a wide range of interests. Our guests are George Uhr, who has a varied background in business. He was a vice president of an international airline. He was a news director in radio. And he started writing about this web bot project back in 2001. And apparently it has been used with great success by a couple of really wealthy investors who use it to sort of figure out, in their words, where and when the sky is going to fall. And then the second guest is a guy who we're just using his first name, Cliff, who has developed this technique for sort of reading computer screens and basically mining the internet for information, and then putting it together to essentially be able to predict future events in near real time. And I guess it's been some remarkable accuracy on the part of their predictions. George and Cliff, thanks for joining us.
Our pleasure. Yeah, glad to be here.
Cliff, let's start with this. Why can't I use your real last name?
You can if you want. I was outed by Jeff Rentz some time back. It's never an issue of anything other than trying to get personality out of the way. I'm not at all important. I'm merely a guy who stumbled on something. It's not like I claim ownership on the idea. I'm not crying for patents or anything. What's important is the information that comes out. The method is intriguing, but the personalities behind it are of really no value, except for George Uhr. He's kind of entertaining for all of us.
Well, is there any concern for both of you guys about having a normal life or being inundated with requests, or do you really take this seriously enough to where you're worried about what's going to happen to your own lives coming in the future?
George, you'd better answer that one.
No, I mean, this is really a garage-built time machine project, if you will. In real life, I consult for companies like eMachine Shop and their affiliated companies. I do sales and marketing for a living, and this is sort of a second life that I've got. Cliff is doing it full time because he's really the brains of the operation. I'm just the marketing front guy.
And Cliff? we do expect impacts. There's no question. This is not something it's not some kind of a scam where we're just pumping the stuff out and sitting back here laughing at everybody buying it up and this kind of thing. So we're actually trying to control the information so that it doesn't go out and cause essentially a karmic ripple that we're not prepared to live with.
Well, we're going to get into what the ripple is in a minute, but I before we leave this part of it, I'm just wondering, you know, I saw the biographical info that came along with this for George, and it says that you now live on a small ranch in a remote part of Texas, and I'm just wondering, are you guys so concerned by the predictions that we're going to talk about now that you're basically hunkering down?
Oh, I hunkered down a long time ago. I actually left Los Angeles in 2005 because in the linguistics we had a large earthquake that was set to occur in along about latitude 34 or so in the Southwest. Turned out to be Southwest Asia, not U.S., but it was the big Pakistani earthquake. I take this stuff serious as a heart attack. I'm out of a big city because I don't want to be there, and you got to ask Cliff, why is he building a boat?
Is that really an ark?
No, not that so much, but something that you might say would sustain itself in extreme conditions, yes.
Well, tell me, let's start this way. How did you develop this thing, and how does it work?
It works, I'll give you the pat answer here, and we can get into as much detail as you figure your audience needs.
Okay.
It becomes quite complex as you drill down into it, and everybody's eyes glaze over when you get into the programming issues. So somebody there pull the plug on me if I get too deep in it.
But basically, I'm your guy. I'm your guy.
Basically, here's the idea. All humans are psychic. Most humans don't know they're psychic. All humans, whether they know it or not about being psychic, leak out this psychic pre-information in their speech pattern. We have a software program that is like any other kind of search engine. It just goes out and reads things. Only ours reads things for an emotional content based on certain words rather than any kind of indexing scheme. We don't read emails. We don't read anything other than publicly available information. And we're not looking for what's printed. We're looking for the changes. We're looking for subtle changes in how language is used in ordinary kind of conversations. And then we assign values to that. And in those values is some meaning that we interpret. Sort of makes sense?
Yeah. So are you saying that, for example, you look for frequency of certain words coming up and how they change?
No, we don't do word
counting. Not frequency.
It's
okay.
Not quite that simplistic. Rather, what we do is we look for archetypes. Why are people using – I can back up and I can say that most Americans may have a vocabulary of 80,000 to 100,000 English language words. In any given week, they really only use perhaps 11,000, depending on the complexity of their particular level of work, up to maybe 20,000. In their private life, they really might only use 5,000 or 6,000 with repetition. And the idea is that within that range, why do they choose one word group over another to express a similar idea? Again, sort of makes sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Is it your belief that, that there's a collective consciousness? You said all humans are psychic, that we all have these powers to one degree or another, but
it's
collectively.
It's my certain knowledge. I've had some enlightenment experiences as a result of long years of meditation that lead me to the full understanding that that is absolutely the case.
And then, but that collectively we're even better than individually.
Much more so.
And how far out are we seeing stuff? How far out do you believe that we can see stuff, whether we know we're seeing it or not?
Some individuals, of course, it's like with any other thing with humans. Humans are what we call fifth-order beings. They exhibit diversity that is just scattered all over the place. You know, giant big humans, little small humans, very smart humans, very fast humans, etc. So there's bound to be extreme cases of psychic ability. Makes sense, right?
Yeah, yeah. So do you guys, the material that was sent to me says you have some wealthy investor kind of guys who pay attention to you, and they invest their money based on the kinds of things that you predict. Do you do this yourself? I mean,
No, I don't really have that much understanding of that kind of an understanding of money. Whenever I do that kind of thing, I fail miserably, as George will tell you from recent experience.
George, can you give me some examples of where this thing has been right on the money or pretty close to it?
Oh, sure. When Cliff and I started corresponding,
Work backwards.
Oh, you mean from the most recent?
Yeah.
Oh,
hey,
okay.
I'll tell you what. We need to take a break.
Okay.
And so you get your thoughts together on working backwards, and we'll come right back, and you can tell us how this thing works. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. We're talking with George Ure and Cliff, two self-described time monks, and I love that term. And I'll tell you, we haven't even heard their success stories yet for how this thing works, but they've got me hooked big time. George, right before the break, you were going to sort of give me a laundry list of the kinds of things where this worked, working backwards. Am I to guess that maybe you guys saw this financial collapse coming?
Oh, sure. That's really been in the data set for, since 2001, 2002.
Yeah, 2002 for sure.
Yeah. And one of the problems with something when we see it way ahead of time is we have this working theory that says the further in advance we can see it, the bigger the event's going to be in terms of impact. So something as small as a couple of American athletes falling off a motorcycle but making big headlines at the Olympic Games, we'll see maybe, what, Cliff, 3 days a week?
Three days, maybe four, yeah.
Yeah, before the event. Or something really big like 2004, the Banda Aceh earthquake, 6-8 months before the event. And similarly, like in May of this year, we put up a public warning the Friday before the China earthquake, and then the day before, I guess 36 hours before the China quake, I put up on my site, which is urbansurvival.com, a public warning called Wedding Quake. And it's curious because the Wedding Quake itself came in two aspects. In other words, there was the Jenna Bush wedding, which happened right in front of the earthquake. And then the second aspect of the Wedding Quake came out 2 weeks later when we saw all those AP pictures out of China of those couples standing in front of the broken-down church that was destroyed in the quake.
Yeah, let me interject here. That's a perfect example of archetypes. Weddings are an archetype that runs deep in all cultures, across all cultures and languages. And we picked up wedding repeatedly, and that was the sort of thing that triggered an action alert, if you will, from us.
So there can be a lot of times when you're getting the clues, you've got the language, but you really don't know what the heck it means until it happens.
Certainly, all the time. We're facing one now.
Well, we'll come to that in a second. Were you up and running prior to 9/11? Were you able to see that one coming?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. George can describe that.
Here's what I'd like to hear. How do you, when you talked about being able to predict this financial crunch back in 2001, 2002, how did you write that? And in what form is it written that says you were onto it and knew about it?
We produced absolutely volumes and reams of information, I think like maybe 3,600 pages so far. Basically what I do is this. I'll extract the language that provides me the clues in the interpretation process and put brackets around it, individual words or phrases. And then I'll string together sentences that provide a background context to those individual words or phrases such that it sort of is a descriptive paragraph. So it's kind of like a novel in that you'd run out of the dialogue and you'd run into a description where they're providing you with information and setting the background. I have to do that for some of the words that I extract that say this word is unique and it's archetypical. And many times I'll have to stop and explain why we think that. So it's not like we just said, on this date, this is going to occur.
Gotcha. So are you also leaving it up to your clients to figure out what the heck it means to some
degree? Frequently, because a lot of times we'll get archetypes that describe things down pretty perfectly. Like we had an incident where, I think it was George Ure that goaded me into it, and I went looking for terrorism specifically. We can run in two modes. We can run our software such that whatever bubbles up to the surface we look at, or we can hunt for specific kinds of context. And a context is a big grouping of words around a central concept. And so I think George had goaded me into it, so I went out looking for terrorism. And lo and behold, we found it after, I think, 3 or 4 days of running through the data. And we predicted that there would be a terrorist-associated power outage 3 weeks in the future, and that it would have the following kind of characteristics. And we described how it would go step by step in the sense that it would flow from an area that had a south-facing exposure, railroad tracks, cranes, where rivers intersect, and so on. We didn't have a specific location. This is one of our problems. People use specific locations so frequently on the Internet, we can't trust them. Because we get so many millions of those, we have to throw them away. So we don't want to be deluded by, for instance, a sudden increase in frequency in the word Niagara, and assume it was going to be at Niagara Falls. This is just an example I bring up, because that's where the power outage ended up starting, was in that particular part of the country. And the reason we got it with the terrorism was that when it came about, it wasn't actually a terrorist act, as far as we know, but rather the first thing that everybody thought was, aha, terrorist act, because they didn't know. They were left in the dark. It had just been so close to our 9/11 experience and all the hyping on it and the fear, et cetera, that the government tries to keep you into the whole time. And there you go. Their first reaction was terrorism. We keyed in on that. It was used in some of the language to describe it, and that's how we ended up with it.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
If I can add one thing.
Sure.
This is also a very good example of the archetype issues that come up in the interpretation of the data, because one of the archetypes that popped out of the pre-Northeast power outage, which, by the way, we documented on a web page. You can find it at Urban Survival, urbansurvival.com/bothit5.htm. Anyway, the point point is that in the language, we had descriptors that went to empty buildings of a city or abandoned city, something like that. And when we look back at the data after the event, it was almost like reading a remote viewing thing, because if you look at those transformers and the switching yards of a power station, they almost look like abandoned buildings sitting among roads of gravel.
Well, also, George, remember, there was actually linguistics that came out that were about some abandoned buildings at the site.
Right.
An abandoned railroad area.
And there were also things going to smell and sewage discharge and things like that, which were part and parcel of that whole sequence of events. So it's almost like looking through some frosted glass or Vaseline smeared over a lens at some event in the future and being able to take parts of the totality, and you never really are positive until the event occurs just what you're seeing. For example, we had the space shuttle disaster, and we were terribly confused by what does it mean, maritime disaster over the West? What the heck is maritime disaster doing over anything? And it occurred to us after the space shuttle disaster that, oh, I get it now. It's a spaceship.
And even more than that, Columbia, gem of the ocean, and we had ocean showing up repeatedly, archetypes for ocean all over the place.
So it's very difficult, especially when we aren't looking for something like space to pop up in the data set. So, you know, obviously our emphasis when we're looking at things, when we hear about maritime disaster, ocean, et cetera, over the West, we're going, what the heck is that? And because you don't think of, when you get an archetype of ocean, you don't think to hunt on words that relate to space, overflight, explosion, things like that, George.
I was going to say that it really does remind me of remote viewing, as you've been describing it, where you get glimpses of what's going to happen, but it's hard to put all the pieces together and get really specific information about exactly what's going to happen.
Yes and no. We can sort of dispute that with one of our latest hits, and that was the Musharraf resignation. We knew down to within, well, let's say 48 hours to be kind to us. We were a couple of days off, but we predicted it 5-6 months out.
Do you get specific assignments from your clients? Do they say, hey,
we don't do that work.
No.
We have in the past, and it has led to results with karmic implications none of us really liked, and so we just don't do that.
Meaning being exploited?
We had a specific example where a very kind individual came along and bailed us out. He asked for a private run based on some parameters I won't go into, and we came up with repeated things about the blessed marriage. And less than 2 weeks later, his wife was killed in a car bomb that was meant for him.
Oh, man. So you don't do it for friends, for family,
Hey,
mom comes to town. She says, can you check this out? No,
nope. We don't do lottery tickets either. The problem, George, is karmically, suppose for a moment that our little garage built time machine actually works as well as it is working. Who would you trust with that? What would you really do with it? I've got an adequate lifestyle. Cliff has an adequate lifestyle. This whole fascination we've got with paper assets is, as we're finding on Wall Street, quite bogus at its core. So what's really the right thing to do? I mean, if you know, assuming everybody dies and leaves all their money here, what do you want to go on to the next life with?
Yeah, you know what? I would imagine that there are a lot of folks out there who don't need to have this technology in their hands. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll get into the predictions for the near future and what you guys see down the road. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Cliff and George, self-described time monks, and this amazing, incredible, and slightly spooky technique that they have developed for basically predicting the past, the future. One of the reasons we're having them on is because their prediction is that something very bad could be coming down the pike real soon, sort of a critical time period coming up in the upcoming week. And when we come back, we're going to ask them exactly what that is. Stay with us on Coast to Coast. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. We're talking with George and Cliff, time monks, an interesting term, about some bad stuff that's coming down the pike. Before we get to that, I do want to go back one other question I had on the current economic turmoil. George, you were telling me about the kinds of terminology you guys had written in advance of this, and you saw it coming a long time ago. Is the worst over? We got some bad stuff coming. Going to get a lot worse. And is this related to the really bad prediction that you've got coming that we'll get into further?
Well, the prequel to the really bad stuff really started back in the March, April kind of time frame. Then we fast forward to the bump we're in right now, which is the window basically from about September 15 through the 27th or so, and then the bad stuff. So are we through it? Not even. We got at least a year of this to go, and it's going to get way ugly.
Meaning the economic part of it gets ugly.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, change your life worse than 9/11. And really, when I say that, it's important to understand the magnitude of what the data is suggesting. It's saying that if you take those 6 days that followed 9/11 and remember how your gut was all just twirling from the stress, the agony, the whole country was feeling grief and pain and rage and all of those emotional release components. Picture not 6 days, but five and a half months of that till March of next year.
And are you saying like a total economic collapse, money being worthless, hoarding?
Sure. Yeah.
Everything, yeah. All that. Yeah. Well, yeah. Give me the laundry list.
It was difficult for us in writing the report to come up with a word that adequately would describe this or encapsulate it. I'm lazy. I'm an old guy. I can't waste time. I like to use as few words as possible to get the idea across. So we have a tendency to try and encapsulate things. Like 2009 is going to be the year of transformation. Gives you a basic idea that things are going to transform themselves. This crash business, or whatever we want to call it, we actually had to hunt around for a word, and because the word that was provided by the data is monumental. But monumental is a strange word because it is applied to something that is static, dead, cold, and in itself is applied to something towards the past. So in other words, the future will look at our current situation that we're approaching within days, and we'll build monuments to it. We'll think of it as monumental. But for us living through it, that word I do not find to be adequate. So I've chosen epic. I'm going to use that word to describe this. What we've got coming up economically alone is an epic situation in which we will have heroes and vast amounts of distress and any kind of chaos you care to name.
Well, and without crossing
millions, you know, that kind of thing.
Without crossing a karmic line here, can you tell me and the listeners what kinds of things, is there anything that can be done to prepare for what's coming? This there part you, of it, the economic
yes,
part of it.
Yes, you can. George is an expert as an economist, and he's been doing exactly that for a number of years, ever since it started getting under his skin in 2002, 2003, that something was truly up. And he can tell you in detail. In fact, that's what urbansurvival.com/week.htm. Or is it HTML, George?
No, it's HTM.
Okay, well, George, tell me then, what exactly is going to happen? What do you think might happen here in the next week in this critical period, and how might my listeners prepare for it?
How to prepare for it's real simple. Have a plan in place so that you are as independent of the existing institutions of society as you can possibly get. What that means is, how will you live if the electricity goes off? What will you do if you don't have water? What do you do if you don't have something to heat your home?
It comes down to personal responsibility.
It really does. I mean, if, you know, when the government came out with their pandemic flu scare, I'll call it a scare, about a year and a half ago, they put up a website called pandemicflu.gov. And if you go there and follow some of their recommendations about, you know, have stored food, have stored water, have clothing for all seasons, have a plan, all that stuff, it really does.
Get extra medicine. Get extra medicine. I can't stress that enough at this point.
Extra medicine.
If you've got the ability to get a prescription medicine and you depend on that prescription medicine, you have to figure that some of these prescription medicines, we can't say which ones, may become unavailable because of conditions that will face this over these coming next 5 or 6 months and then beyond.
Meaning either where it's manufactured or the distribution system.
Correct.
Okay.
And then how are you going to cope if oil goes to $500 per barrel or higher? I mean, we're talking about events that could push.
Or let's look at it the other way. It may be that we have the Jazz Jane situation where we get the massive deflation in the sense that the event works out such that it doesn't matter that oil falls to $80 a barrel. No one's working, so why bother buying gas? You don't have money anyway.
And is this the kind of thing where, you know, that people are going to just hunker down?
This is the kind of thing where the other nations on the planet are going to be so scared of what's going to happen in the U.S. that they are going to take every kind of precaution they possibly can, including mobilizing their military and assuming we're going to go absolutely crazy and lash out at the world in our frustration as this thing goes down.
Which could lead to other cataclysms, I guess.
Correct.
Right. And if you're worried about the Middle East, Iran, Georgia, yeah, those are legitimate things to worry about.
Now, help me understand this. Are we, the sequence of events that you're describing is because of what's already on the table, our financial mess that we're in right now?
Correct.
That's a directly outgrowth of that.
Which began in 1913.
The problem with fractional reserve currency systems is they always end badly. I mean, gold and silver have been around for thousands of years. There isn't a paper currency around today that's been around 100.
And the United States itself has gone through four existent periods in its history in which we had a currency that we lost. Confederate dollars, greenback dollars, private banking, etc. Continental.
Federal Reserve notes.
They don't last long.
Certificates.
Only this time we've got an epic proportional kind of a situation because the American Empire has used its military since the 1918 situation around in there, maybe even earlier in World War I. But we've used our military to extend our single largest product, which is the dollar bill. The dollar bill is theoretically the global reserve currency, but it is not backed by anything other than, let's quote it out exactly, the good faith and credit of the United States. Well, we don't have any good faith anymore. We've got a bunch of lying crooks in charge. Everybody knows this. Everybody knows they're psychopaths, sociopaths, and that they're really dangerous. And we don't have any good credit anymore because we've blown that with the last of our housing issues. So now we have this crisis of confidence in the dollar ahead of us.
So right now, I mean, people listening to this program, buy some food, buy some water.
Be smart about it. We're not telling people to go panic and do any of this kind of stuff. You have a couple of weeks to get this all together, and even then, you have to understand you cannot store enough food to get by indefinitely. There's no point getting more than your minimum requirements because there may be dislocations that require you to have to move, you know, in the case of fleeing hurricanes, that sort of thing.
Do you worry that some of this becomes self-fulfilling? You guys are on this program telling a couple of million people this is going to happen, and then they create it.
Sure, exactly. That's why we have to be very careful. We're not advocating bank runs. I personally think it's kind of silly because the say you went and got all of your money. Well, money itself may be worthless in 2 months.
So what about gold?
That would be different. If you could get some, I would certainly think that it's likely to hang out. But there's a lot of stuff in the longer term data that suggests that the preoccupation with money will soon become something of a less intense part of our society than it is now.
What do you mean?
I mean that because of what we're facing over these next few years, the social order, how we interact, our general social contract will change, and we're going to start seeing the emergence of what we've been calling SOCs, self-organizing collectives. And so we'll start interacting with each other in a different way that will be less exchange-based and less money-based. And
there almost communal?
There won't be this huge culture of celebrity or this culture of wealth.
Geez, I'm not going to miss that. Almost communal, you're describing.
No, not really.
No,
really,
no.
What it is, George, is right now global corporatism works because instead of having a guy who makes shoes in Tyler, Texas, to serve the folks of the Tyler area, we found somebody cheaper to make our shoes for us in Indonesia, India, China, Pakistan, Singapore, all of these other places, right? And so the intrinsic value of the shoe is always the same. The reason globalism works is because it takes cheap labor overseas, turns it into goods and services, and ships them to America.
And what makes them cheap? The plentiful printing of dollars.
Right, right. So we just print up dollars and play the labor rate differential.
And that's coming home to roost. I mean,
that's
what we've seen.
That's going to come home to roost in a huge way. And as a result, we're going to go through a period more than likely, if we're reading the data right, probably a good primer for how to prepare would be something like Dmitry Orlov's book, Reinventing Collapse, how really Russia was, the Soviet Union, was more prepared for the kind of economic dislocation than we are in America, because we are almost totally dependent on the internet, on the electric power grid, and so forth, whereas large parts of the Soviet Union were relatively low-tech, and yet they still went through a horrific period of collapse and resource stripping, gleaning from garbage, all of that kind of stuff. We don't want to think about that. It's just not comfortable. So along comes October 7th through March of next year, and like it or not, linguistically, based on Cliff's work, that's what's coming down the pike.
What's this period, September 22nd to the 27th?
That's a plateau of building tension. Everybody is all upset. We're currently in a mode where your stomach is tight over this economic thing. It doesn't sit well. Your muscles are tense. You're not sleeping right. There is more and more building language about it. So we're going to get to the point where we're at a point now where this level of tension will be sustained with more or less little tiny blips up and down until we get to the 7th, and then it releases and goes into release language.
I was sort of talking about this becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy. I'm just wondering, and I know you got to be careful in this regard, but people out there want to buy a car. They're thinking about buying a house. This is not a time to be maybe jumping into something like that where you're extending yourself.
You got to start asking yourself the question in a different way. Am I willing to put myself into further debt and enslavement to someone for that particular possession? Because that's what you're facing right now. If you have credit cards, you're a debt slave to those credit cards, because the powers that be passed laws, the new Bankruptcy Act, which says you can't walk away from those. And
right.
If you do, by the way, and they forgive you, then you still owe the government tax on all that's been forgiven. If you run up $30,000 worth of debt, pay it off for $3,000 in a settlement, then you still owe tax on the $27,000 delta.
Right, they consider it income.
Correct.
Tell me this. We're describing a pretty grim scene here of the economic consequences.
Right.
Is there something else, though? Or when you're talking about dire consequences, or is there something else looming out there that's maybe even worse after
we can put it this way. The situation is complex, which means it's not going to be a single trigger and a single element that causes all of our distress. We have a certain ratios, if you will, that suggest that it's going to be about 45 to 48% economic and something close to 40% military, and then the rest will be what we call terra intrusions or earth activities in the form of hurricanes or large storms, that kind of thing.
And when you're talking about military, you mean our military acting or somebody else's military acting?
We get militaries as archetypes, and we can't go with geographic. It is most likely us, because who's got the biggest military on the planet? Who's got the most stressed out military? Who's got the most malfunctioning, dysfunctional military leadership at the civilian level? Well, hey, we got to claim that title, folks.
On the other hand, whether it's martial law or a military reaction to some terrorist event,
real or imagined,
or manufactured.
Correct. Yeah, we're trying to be subtle about that. But yeah, that's coincidentally, if you look at how 9/11 happened, we were in a huge economic collapse then, which was the blow up of the internet bubble. The internet bubble was blowing up. Along came Osama bin Laden and the 9/11 crew, and what happens? We have a war on terror. We are overnight able to mobilize the same scale of economic response that characterized the Works Progress Administration back in the 1930s and the Civilian Conservation Corps and so forth.
Magnified by the size of our population and the speed of the communication. Let's not forget that. That's why this situation is going to be
different.
Different.
Different
than
the Great Depression. We'll call it the Great Delevering.
I mean, do you see, because of this economic turmoil, the possibility of a manufactured terrorist event that leads to other dramatic, terrible things?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, how certain is that? I mean, is it, do you have a scale?
There's the rub. We have a, that's within our 45% of maximum of a military component for what we're facing.
And is there any value in you talking about it in terms of value? I mean, that it is not inevitable.
We don't have anything that would do anything other than induce panic unnecessarily. Panic is good. I mean, it's an emotional reaction. It causes the body to do things when survival is necessary.
But so, is it inevitable is what I'm wondering.
I don't know. Now, there's an idea. Let's talk about this hypothetically. Let's assume that George and I are not doing this, okay? But if for instance, one knew the future to a certain extent, could one hijack the future knowing that the planet is really run in this complex sort of a matrix that we'll call constant co-creation or constant creation? It may be possible to do so. In other words, if enough people knew, if you had 5 million people sitting around on September the 10th saying, I wonder what those bastards are up to. What's going to happen tomorrow? Would it have happened? Ask yourself that.
Well, we've got 2 million who are listening to you right now. Wow.
I mean, we would love to be spectacularly wrong.
It would be perfect. It would be great.
Yeah.
I would have a happy life. I'm an old bald guy. I don't need this. My ambition for career goal is to be a boat bum. I would finish my boat and go happily sailing off.
Well, this is sort of where we began this interview, and I asked George if it's a coincidence, you know, that you're there in Texas, and he mentioned you building your boat, but it sounds like both of you guys are getting ready for what you think is going to happen.
Well, the reason for the boat we haven't even gotten into yet.
I'm only 135 feet off the water where I'm at.
Well, let's talk about the boat.
Basically, what I am assuming is going to occur because of some data we've got that suggests that in 2009 we're going to have what's called a global coastal event. And it's going to be disruptive to the global human society. Doesn't necessarily mean giant tsunami. It could be as little as a 5-foot tide differential and no boats could dock, for instance. If it were a 30-foot wave or a small tsunami or something like this, we might lose bridges all over and we may need boats for transportation in the area I'm at because without bridges, we can't move, as was recently illustrated when Washington State got flooding in Lewis County and it shut down a few miles of I-5. With very little water, actually. So it's kind of a thing to sort of prepare for. If you're living around a lot of water and water stops you from going anywhere and it's also a resource, might be handy to have a boat in the next year or two.
I think maybe I'm safe here in the Mojave Desert. But
yeah, you should be. But on the other hand, December 10 through 12, we've also got a China-sized earthquake coming up in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
This global coastal event, could it be as something as subtle as the global warming stuff?
It could be. It could also be something like a big mass of ice that's currently sitting on some land, sliding off, and causing over the course of 5 or 6 months, again, another long-term event, this global coastal event that we're going to be experiencing.
Well, I'll tell you, fellas, it's a fascinating conversation, but you're no barrel of laughs here so far.
No one likes the podcast anymore, yeah.
Maybe we'll look for some fun stuff when we come back after this break.
That's
a fascinating stuff. We'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM.